This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Oh, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. And all of you driving around the various counties, enjoying the weather, pretending that it's summertime and lounging around your backyard, weeding your flower gardens. Thanks for tuning in. I got all the cool people in here today. Rusty's here, Ann's here. I got Michael here. I have Kurt here. Please be kind to Kurt. We'd like Kurt to take over from Michael once Michael goes away to New York University. And our guest, Barbara Norton. Barbara, how you doing?
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. I love coming on this show.
Well, thank you so much. Barbara Norton, former columnist at The Hook, and further and further and further back, our other alternative newspaper here in town. And she's here today. We're going to talk about some unsolved mysteries here in the Charlottesville area. We got a handful that we can mention, but we're going to try and focus on one or two. Lazarus is here in the studio with us today, my dog. If you hear the occasional jingle of tags, that's Lazarus. Maybe you'll be hearing him all the way down to Harrisonburg on 95.1. Let me take a moment and get this. Where's my big piece of paper? Let's thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for being with us today. They are your source for outdoor sandals as well as gear for spring travel, including shorts, duffel bags, and cool sun hats. You'll find Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Barracks Road Shopping Center here in Charlottesville and at brms.com. All right, before we get started, like I said, Lazarus is here in the studio with me today. We had an incident with Lazarus this weekend. Lazarus was out at my girlfriend's place down in Levinson. Lazarus wandered off. Lazarus never wanders very far because he always wants to come back and crash on a very cushiony area, and certainly would never go anywhere where he might miss a meal. And Lazarus did not come back for the evening. Fortunately, one of the neighbors called and said, "Hey, by the way, I have Lazarus, if you would like to come get him." And the only reason that happened was because Lazarus has tags. Now, I don't care whether your area requires you to pay some fee for having your dog. That's none of my business if you want to pay your fee for being a pet owner. But everybody who owns pets, cats and dogs and other animals that wander around, should have tags on your animal. That's a key factor in case an incident like this happens. Fortunately, the neighbor, very friendly, very nice, took care of Lazarus, put him in a safe position and safe environment, and eased my stress that was ever growing by calling the number on the tags. So please, please, make sure your animal has tags. You don't have to go to the city or the county to get them. PetSmart, Pet whatever, something Pet, you can get the tags lasered up on a piece of metal for $3, $4, $5. So please get your animal some pet. Get your pet some tags. All right, on to today's topic: unsolved mysteries. Dun 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 dun. Barbara Norton here. Now, we've got a handful, right, Barbara? You have written, from what I gathered, at least articles about three different unsolved mysteries in the area, correct?
Yes, and one of them is what I call my consuming passion. That's the disappearance in 1986 of Pat Collins, who was a University of Virginia graduate student who disappeared into thin air under very odd circumstances. That was the first one I investigated and continue to look into, but there's unfortunately not much to look into anymore. The most recent was the murders of Julie Williams and Lolly Winans up near the Appalachian Trail and Skyline Drive area. Those are unsolved, though a man was indicted and later unindicted for those murders. And in between a most amazingly complex and extremely tragic, well, they were all tragic, disappearance of a young woman in 1999 from Stribling Avenue. Her name was Judy Jones. So those are the three that I have focused on.
And we're going to start today, and you know what? I've already thought that there's no way we're going to get into all this. We've had you on over the last decade, I think, that I've been doing this. We've had you on at least twice, it comes to mind, and maybe three times, to talk about the Pat Collins case. And I'm thinking that if things work out that way, we'll break up today's hour into Judy Jones and then the two young women along the Appalachian Trail. We're going to start with Judy Jones. And if it doesn't work so that we can split them up, you're coming back later this summer to talk about the Appalachian Trail, ladies.
I'd be happy to.
All right. But today we're going to start with Judy Jones, May 1969. Now, Barbara, I have to ask, if people are listening, you just mentioned three different, you read an article on all three different incidents. Why are you so caught up in this, I don't even know the proper word for it. Why are you so caught up in this, you know, in this kind of stuff that happens in people who disappear or, you know, or in case of the two women on the Appalachian Trail, there are bodies that are found. What fascinates you?
Well, I grew up reading Nancy Drew, and I'm sure that many of our listeners have a similar love of mysteries. Each one of these cases absolutely enthralled me. Very, very complex. I find that all the dynamics of the various parties involved in all three so intriguing, so fraught in the cases of Pat Collins and Judy Jones, and then in the case of Julie and Lolly, just they were the victims of a just savage, horrible, brutal massacre. In the disappearances, which are so, you know, elusive because they weren't ever solved. No body has ever been found, either Pat or Judy. But it's quite obvious. Anyone looking at these two cases would have to conclude that they were almost certainly killed very quickly after they disappeared. Or, I mean, that was, you know, why they disappeared. They had been murdered. And both were met with a lot of deception. In Pat's case, the University of Virginia Police Department, I don't know if you'd call this deception or just terrible ineptitude, really refused to investigate. In Judy's case, I think there's very strong evidence that her stepfather murdered her accidentally. The mother, probably in horror, joined him in covering it up. And then ever after swore that Judy had just run off in the middle of the night with some guy on a motorcycle. Not likely. So I'm just drawn in by the details and the conundrum and the digging through the old city directories and the going to the neighborhood where they happened, or in the case of Julie and Lolly, to the campsite, and picturing what it looked like, you know, all those years ago, the injustice in each of these cases, in any attack on one human being by another, gets overwhelming at times. I have to really rein myself in. Just the horror of all this stuff is
awful. Let's start. You know, we mentioned Judy Jones. This is an incident from 1969. The articles, by the way, this is Barbara Norton here in the studio today, who's written articles about several unsolved mysteries in the Charlottesville, Albemarle area. Judy Jones was thought to be, or I guess officially written to be, a runaway. No body ever found. No physical body ever located after this disappearance. So she's written off to be a runaway, correct?
Yes. And before we go into Judy, I want to be sure that I say this. The only reason I ever got onto this fascinating, tragic story was because of Paul Jones, who is no relation. After my first article on, or second article on Pat Collins had come out, Paul came up to me at a Seville Weekly Christmas party and said he had been really engrossed by the Pat Collins stuff and remembered it very clearly. And he said, you got to get into Judy Jones. He says, I can tell you all kinds of background on this that no other people don't know. And we met, and by the time we were done, I was teething at the bit. Judy Jones lived with her mother Hazel and her stepfather Tom in a big barn-like house that is at the dead end of Stribling Avenue. Well, it's not literally dead end, but if you're driving down Stribling from JPA, it's the very last big house on your left.
Now, because not everybody who's listening lives in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
You know, we reach out to Harrisonburg,
sure,
et cetera.
Sure.
But for those who have some familiarity with the Charlottesville area, I think a good landmark is Dirty Nelly's and the Wayside Fried Chicken place, correct?
Yes.
So you go over that hump where the railroad tracks are. And then is it the first right-hand turn, the second right-hand turn? But it's right there.
It's right there.
So it's in that, it's very close in that neighborhood to the railroad tracks, to the Dirty Nellies and the Wayside Deli Chicken Spot.
It's a weird street. It's a very, very long street. And in 1969, it was practically rural. In fact, Paul Jones's parents, who by then had moved back to New York, owned that house. He and his family had lived there for a few years when his father was on the faculty here, and so he knew the house very well, and they had rented it out to Hazel and Tom with the proviso that any time one of their sons wanted to come back to Charlottesville for a visit, they could stay in a couple of little rooms tucked into the very back of the house. So Paul began coming there to see a woman, weirdly enough, named Judy, who he later married, no relation, staying there when he would come to see her on weekends. And so he got to know Hazel and Tom. Well, then, Judy, a 21-year-old with four children, moved in. And that's where things got really interesting, in a sad way. Now, I have to tell you that Judy had gotten pregnant in seventh grade, which would have been, I think it was, 8 years earlier. Picture this, Stanton, Virginia, 1961, a 13-year-old seventh grader getting pregnant. So this is quite a shocking concept for me at all. That must have been just unheard of. She ended up at the last minute in a home for unwed mothers, marrying the father who was based at Quantico nearby. They went on to have three more children in rapid order. So he was out to sea. He was in the Navy. This was Vietnam. Charlottesville was, comparatively speaking to Stanton, where she'd been raised, a pretty happening place. And she was very attractive. She was blonde, and she was hot, as Paul would say. She was hot. And she was working at what was then the Village Inn as a waitress. It's now Anna's Pizza. She was hanging out also at a bar called the Sip and Sizzle. I wish I could have seen it, which is where Sycamore House is now downstairs at Studio Art on West Main. And she, imagine being 21 years old in 1969 and having four kids. Just, she was really ready to party.
Yes, that's very productive.
Yeah. Hazel and Tom were less than thrilled to have Hazel's daughter and four grandchildren move into a small apartment with them. Well, things must have begun moving toward this awful denouement sometime around the end of April. On either the night of May 1st or May 2nd, we don't know now, we will never know, Judy went to the emergency room at UVA in what we now will probably forever call the old hospital in the ER, and there she was diagnosed tentatively as having gonorrhea.
Now why won't you know?
Well,
which night? Because that's part of your, you know, this was an article that you wrote. How long ago did you write this article now? Almost a decade ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, I wrote it in 1998 with, of course, Paul.
You sent it to me, and I read it. But one of the key factors in you attempting to determine exactly what happened is whether or not this all happened in this sort of condensed amount of time, or whether it had an extra 24 hours mm-hmm. to all take place. So why wouldn't you know whether it was May 1st or May 2nd?
Well, we can pin down that she was at the emergency room at midnight. The record, which I have, courtesy of the family, says 5/1/69/12 midnight. The nurse, if it was May 2nd, it had been May 1st all, it had been May 1st all day, and if that was the first note she wrote at midnight on the 2nd, she could have gotten the day wrong. I kind of doubt that. She was reported that she had disappeared on May 2nd. Of course, adults, they want a 24-hour, lag time before you report. We were never able to make sure that time on that record, which, of course, was handwritten, especially back then, was correct, whether she disappeared then. Later that day, and Hazel and Tom waited 24 hours to report it. We don't know. What we do know is that when she left there, apparently she believed she had gonorrhea. She'd been put on an antibiotic. She had been almost certainly told, as I think is standard with STDs, that she needed to notify any sex partners.
All right, so we have a 21-year-old woman. She's not divorced, correct? But her husband is in the military, and so he's off doing his military issues. She is with her children, her four children, living with her mom and stepdad. Okay. Mm-hmm. Because I want to sort of lay out the entire groundwork and then go back and fill in mm-hmm. the mystery holes. She has a job. We know that she's young, even though she has the four kids, and she's bored with the everyday life of being the mother staying at home. She wants to, be social. Make new friends, have a good time, etc.
Yes. This was not a happy marriage, to put this very mildly. He had coerced her into posing for nude pictures, for instance, and then one family member felt that he was also just sharing them with the guys on the ship. I mean, he was a piece of work.
All right, so at some point in either May 1st or May 2nd, she goes to the emergency room.
Yes.
She's determined to have gonorrhea.
Mm-hmm.
She's given the antibiotic. Because we don't think that there's any difference between whether or not that happened today or whether that happened in 1969, the technician, the doctor, the nurse says, you need to tell anyone who's been a sexual partner.
Right. That would be the standard treatment.
Within 24 hours or 36 hours, she's missing.
She's missing.
And they don't, and we'll get into this in a little more detail, but there are a variety of stories that are told that she rode off on the back of a motorcycle, that she would never do that, that some of the kids say they saw a fight take place in the house, et cetera. Right? So that's the big, plate full of, of information that we have.
Well, we can get a little more grounded in fact than that. We do know that last night she had a violent argument at the house with Hazel and Tom. or at least with someone. But considering the night and who, you know, the time of day and who lived there, it would have definitely been Hazel and Tom. And, well, we know it was, in fact. She called her father, Maynard, who was apparently a wonderful guy over in the valley in Stanton, and said, I can't stay here. Tom called the stepfather. Apparently he was very profane, very angry, and said, come over here and get your daughter. You know, I want her out of this house. So Maynard said, well, let me talk to her. She came on the phone and said, I don't want you driving over the mountain in the middle of the night. I'll be okay till morning.
Why didn't she move in with Maynard?
Well, they were happy. She started there when her husband got deployed to Vietnam. She moved back from, I guess, California. She had wanted to divorce him, and her father said no. She said, well, then let me. He said, don't do that. She said, well, let me come home to Virginia anyway while he's gone. So she started in Stanton, and living with Maynard and her stepmother must have been a little more placid than what Judy Jones wanted to be doing in 1969, which was kick up her heels with her husband finally
gone. So it wasn't
gone.
The home life. It was the social life that
Very much so. So there's this violent argument, this very emotional phone call to her father, and the father hanging up saying, I will come get you in the morning, and her saying, I'll be okay till morning. Now, the fascinating...
All right, hold on to the rest of that.
Sure.
Because the whole thing is fascinating, and we're going to keep going through it. Barbara Norden here, as we talk about unsolved mysteries in the Charlottesville area and beyond. But currently we're focusing on Judy Jones from 1969, article, one of the many articles that Barbara Norden has written for The Hook and for other weekly alternative newspapers in our area that don't underwrite on this particular program. 11:21 on the wake-up call. Feel free to dial up and ask your questions. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny today, highs 70 to 75. Cooler in the valley. Clear tonight, lows 40 to 45. Sunny tomorrow, highs 70 to 75. Right now in the valley, 64, 67 in Lynchburg. A few clouds in Richmond, we're at 75. And oh, so nice in Charlottesville, 68.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
Oh, let's thank Blue Ridge Graphics for their support today. You can find them at Mead Avenue and East High Street, serving Charlottesville with custom T-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746. And at brgtshirts.com. And before we get back to Barbara Norden, let me remind those of you who made pledges in the recent fund drive but haven't paid them yet, please do so as soon as possible. People can take your payment and help you with your premiums or here until 7 p.m. on weekdays and sometimes later, and then even on weekends now and again, especially if you call first. We're at 2250 Old Ivy Road in Charlottesville behind the Ivy Inn restaurant. Zip code 22903. Second round of written reminders to those with unpaid pledges is going out next week. And thanks again to those who've already honored their pledges to help us reach over 92% collection on the $88,000 pledged. All right, we are talking with Barbara Norden about unsolved mysteries here in Charlottesville. Currently, we're talking about Judy Jones, who disappeared in early May of 1969. Feel free to call up if you have a question or a comment. Maybe you're listening today and you were around at the time and remember with the Daily Progress or other news areas covered that. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Barbara, we were talking about how Judy's father, Maynard, factors into this because she had a good relationship with Maynard.
Yes.
And my question was, well, why not stay with Maynard rather than stay in this sort of this relationship with her mom and her stepdad that was a lot more difficult for everyone?
Real difficult, it turned out. Yeah, this was a, You know, 1969, it was a year before UVA let women in across the board. It was easy to meet men. She was very good looking. She had spent, imagine being either pregnant or taking care of a child from the age of 13 on. Just astonishing. Well, this violent phone call, Maynard came over early the next morning, 7 o'clock in the morning. Hazel and Tom wouldn't let him in the house, and that's where the grandchildren were, so he didn't get to talk to any of the kids significantly. Just kept insisting she had disappeared on the back of a motorcycle in the middle of the night. So he believed him and kind of retreated home next, whether it was the next day or later that day, and I suspect it would have been the next day.
Did they give any reason as to why he couldn't come in the house?
No.
I mean, just, if the kid, okay, so she... Okay, your daughter went off on the back of a motorcycle, but you can't even come in and see your grandkids.
No, no, which is, of course, one of the things that later would seem so significant to him and the rest of Judy's family. The family at first took this for granted. Judy was kind of flighty, and they could tell that she really was, you know, living kind of a semi-wild life. She finally had someone to take care of her kids, and she was going out. And so at first they bought into that, and then it wasn't too long before they didn't, and they hired a private detective, and nothing ever came of it. Well, now, in the meantime, while Hazel and Tom are just insisting Judy ran away in the middle of the night...
Let me ask you real quick. All right, so they're insisting she ran away in the middle of the night, and obviously we're leaning closer and closer to saying that somebody here is a prime suspect. Are mm-hmm. these people still alive?
No.
Are these their proper names?
Hazel and Tom, they're first
filed against them. I mean, I don't want to be sitting here dragging somebody's name through,
well,
you know, through the airwaves.
No, I changed their last name in the article. They're both dead.
Okay.
Yeah, so we don't need to worry about that.
But do they have children who might be bothered by the fact that we're talking about this?
No. I mean, Judy's four children, all of whom are well aware that, in fact, one I write to, they know that I've written about this before, and that's not something we need to worry about. So anyway, the family began suspecting strongly that something had happened to Judy that night, that she had not run away, but they weren't able to prove it. Now, we need to just take a little detour and explain how the husband reacted to all this. He came home from Vietnam, and he put all the kids in an orphanage. Huh? I mean, what do you do when your wife disappears, leaving your four motherless children? Just stick them in an orphanage and go on with your life. Now, the daughter, the littlest one, Sandy, cousins in his family wanted to adopt her, or were willing to. They wanted the one girl. They did not want the three boys. So picture this. You just stick your three little boys in an orphanage in Lynchburg, remarry, go to dental school, and go on with your life. He's a dentist somewhere north of Winchester now. And the family, even though Maynard and his wife and her Judy's brother and sister, everyone, they were all very close to these kids and Maynard and his wife wanted badly to raise them. David was so bitter. He told me later that when he divorced Judy, he divorced her family, refused. And they tried to take him to court. There was no way. And so they were forced to apparently, they were not even allowed to stay in touch. So they weren't even real sure where the kids had gone. They knew that the couple's last name and that they lived somewhere over in the valley, and that was really about it. Years and years and years passed, literally. In 1995, Judy's older sister, Carol, had a friend who would, as her own private volunteer mission, she would go into one of the prisons over in the valley and visit with prisoners who didn't have any regular visitors. So she was describing this one young man's very interesting background, and Carol said, that has got to be Judy's son, Bobby. It has got to be. because it just, or actually the woman said this to herself because she knew Maynard's wife's twin. She said, I know this has to be part of the whole Judy Jones thing. This must have been one of Judy's children. Well, she got hold of relatives who got hold of Carol. They had this big, you know, I don't think, oh yes, they did go right away. They saw Bobby in prison. They were led to the other children. Now, Sandy, who had been very cosseted and wanted in that adoptive family, did not want to start a relationship. One of the boys told me later, I guess the oldest boy, David, told me later that they had really only wanted the sons for farm labor. They had not been treated, you know, at all the same as their sister had been. And there were not real good feelings between them and the family. But what happened was Carol found out when Carol and her husband Glenn went to meet Charlie, who was the next to youngest, in Atlanta. They found out that he had, and had always had, a very clear memory of what had happened the night of the argument.
All right, well, let's get into that. It is 11:30 here on the Wake Up Call. Barbara Norden here in the studio has written several articles about unsolved mysteries in the Charlottesville, Central Virginia area. We're focusing today on Judy Jones, who disappeared in very early May of 1969. Now, Barbara, you mentioned earlier meeting Paul Jones, a police officer at the time?
No.
Private detective?
No. He was just an individual. His parents had owned this house.
But unrelated to Judy Jones.
Oh, yeah.
And the two of you got together in the 90s mm-hmm. to start doing your own investigating on this.
Yep.
I'm curious because I'd like to know what happened in the 90s in terms of Charlottesville police work to find this out, and then what prompted you to start looking in the 90s?
Very good question. People may remember that there was a kind of blip on the radar screen in, probably 1996, shortly after. Well, I have to explain this part before we go on, what I was getting ready to say. They found out that Charlie's memory was that Judy had shepherded the four kids into what usually was a dining room, but apparently was where all the kids were sleeping when they lived there. The room had two doors on walls that were at right angles. One looked into the kitchen through the old-fashioned keyhole. One looked into the foyer. What Charlie remembered and had written down, and then they later gave this to the FBI, very clearly, he said his memory had never changed. The violent, violent argument started, and he was looking through the keyhole into the kitchen. He saw his mother's head being snapped across the kitchen counter, and he could just see a hand wrenching a big hank of hair out of her scalp, and her scalp beginning to bleed. And then she was screaming, and she ran out of the kitchen. Apparently, she was trying to get probably out the front door, because then he went to the door at right angles to that and was looking into the entry hall, and he saw her body on the floor, and he just saw that he was being dragged out of his sight. Okay, that's what he remembered. That's what he told Carol and Glenn. He put it out down in a statement. The statement went to the FBI. Next thing people here know is opening the progress up and seeing that the FBI, the state medical examiner, some archaeologists, and the city police have descended on the house on Stribling Avenue and are looking to see if the body's buried somewhere in the front or backyard. Well, Paul opened up the paper. Number one, his wife was named Judy Jones, and it's his house on Stribling Avenue, and kind of freaked out. And then he remembered, oh, wait. That was Hazel's daughter. Hazel had hung around town for years. She divorced Tom, but Paul had actually known her. They both worked on the corner, and every time she ran into him, she would make a point of saying, apparently, I guess Judy just ran away and left me with those kids. Well, so he went over. They packed up their tents. They said, oh, we didn't find anything after one day, basically, and left. Well, Paul went over, and he went to the city police and said, look, I can see you left all the excavation flags. The place that was the most obvious place for this body to be buried would have been in what was in 1969 a small horse barn, kind of at the drop-off back part of the property, which is now terribly overgrown. Drag her out there, lift up a floorboard, bury her, put it back down. Don't be digging a hole in the backyard in the middle of the night. That's going to be kind of obvious. So they said, oh, no. We chucked everything out. It's okay. Well, that's why Paul was, came up to me that night.
But why wouldn't the 1969 police, when the barn was there, why wouldn't they have been looking in the barn? Is that because they believed the story about her getting on the motorcycle?
Sure. They've got two adults, supposedly responsible adults, one of them her mother, saying she went away in the middle of the night. She was wild. She was working as a waitress. Husband's in Vietnam. All the prejudice in the world probably came to bear on this blonde woman in a miniskirt and a beehive and a lot of makeup and not wanting to have the responsibility of her kids, going off in the middle of the night. Ho-hum. Charlottesville police apparently didn't have more than enough time to just say, well, I guess she ran away, and, they never went into it any further. So that's why Paul was so fascinated in saying, look, we got to investigate this. So what we did was, and where my article opened, is he said there's this in the basement, which you had to go behind the house and into a separate door to get into it. He said, there's a crawl space. He said, I want to see that crawl space. So we went over there. The students living upstairs gave us permission to look around. Went into this dank, yucky, old, weird basement area, furnace and everything, coal room. And across,
I think they're called crawl space, Barbara.
Well, no, it was a basement.
It wasn't. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of those. Too many snakes.
It's
and bugs.
Like a big old-fashioned basement. And then on one wall, there's a ledge that was about probably 4 feet high. And then opening onto that ledge is an opening going into a crawl space that goes directly under the house. And Paul said, I want to get in there and see. And I really thought he was being obsessive. I thought there's nothing in there. So I'm waiting around, ho-hum, got the flashlight, waiting for him to come back. All of a sudden, he's crawling back out of the hole.
Now, when is this? This is 1990.
98.
So almost 20 years later, right?
Oh, almost 30 years later.
Okay, yeah, good use of your math skills, Rick. So almost 30 years later, and at this point, during this whole time, the only thing anybody's done is, put some red flags, little marker flags up in the yard and use all the technology at the time to see if they needed to dig here or there.
Yeah, and then they just departed. Yeah. So he comes crawling back out, and he's got a broken-off shovel in one hand, and in the other, what looks like a big rag. So he gets out of the hole. We go over and hold it up in the light, and it's what had been a small woman's kimono kind of bathrobe. I could tell it had been really nice, and it had been, looked like the fabric had been ripped. I could tell by the way that the fibers were probably just not like torn violently, but intentionally, like maybe cut at the top and ripped off to make a rag. And it had, it was stained with something. God only knows what. It'd been buried in dirt in the back of this crawl space for almost 30 years. If this was connected. And then he had also found what looked like a length of drapery material and an old towel, plus the broken-off shovel. So we're thinking, what if you have accidentally hit your stepdaughter, with whom, by the way, I have the feeling that the oldest boy, in his memory, he was 8 when they were living there, he didn't remember Hazel, the grandmother. He thought Tom and Judy were a couple.
You mentioned in your article that, and I don't remember the ages, but you Judy is 21,
mm-hmm.
and then that Tom is 10 Tom, or more years younger than Hazel.
Yeah, Tom, her stepfather, was about 11 years younger than Hazel. Paul said that Tom was really kind of very obsessive about sex, you know, the kind of sort of creepy guy who always wants to, you know, talk about, like, sex with younger guys.
Dirty comments.
And he would make comments about his wife and say, look at the ass on her and stuff like that. I mean, he was kind of creepy. And it's not hard for me to believe that Judy and he, while Hazel was gone, you know, might have been kind of having a party at the house. Also, Bobby told me that the basement and the crawl space, that whole area, were very much Tom's domain, and he didn't want the kids going down there.
And there also, as you mentioned earlier, that it is believed that Judy had come back from the hospital being
identified
as having gonorrhea and being told to let anyone that she'd had a relationship with know that this was the case. So that might be another reason that Paul Jones believe that Tom is a key factor and and possibility or probability in what happened.
Yeah, I mean, what if she'd been, you know, knew she had to tell him, and Hazel got wind of it, it all came out, and Tom's probably swearing he's innocent, and the mother's furious, and this violent argument erupts, and as she's trying to escape out the front door, he's trying to yank her back, and oops, she, you know, hits her head too hard on the steps or something, and next thing Charlie knows, he's seeing his mother being dragged out of his sight.
All right, let me do this. 11:40 here on the Wake Up Call. Barbara Norden in the studio today. We're talking about the unsolved mystery of Judy Jones from 1969. Lots of interesting stuff. I mean, it all ties together. I don't know, can you still get to this online or not?
Now, Seville at that time didn't have anything online. I've got paper copies, and if anyone wants to contact the station, I'm sure Rick could get names and addresses, and I've got copies. I'd be happy to send people.
AbstractMe@AOL.com if you're interested in getting Barbara Norden's published newspaper article on this. Let me do this.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, The Hook. In case you were curious, there's a new magazine that captures the lifestyle for the lively 50-plus generation, not your stereotypical seniors. Read about it in The Hook. And Virginia is for lovers, but according to officials in Stanton, only for those who can keep their amorous shenanigans completely under wraps. The Hook. Look for that bright red box to get your fun every weekend. And 45fix.com, they're giving us some support today. If you have a home improvement project, there's another way to find a contractor. It's 45fix.com. From remodeling to repair projects, immediate no-obligation estimates are available anytime. That's 45fix.com, the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. And at noon, Drew Thompson will be here for Les Temps Purdue, the best of 80s and 90s alternative. No Michael Jackson, no Britney Spears, no Chicago. But you will hear Silverchair, Tears for Fears, and Sushi and the Banshees. And requests are always welcome, especially to Rhonda Choluk, who will be filling in for Drew Thompson today on Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music. And while I take a few seconds here, next week, Mother's Day, please remember your mother. I am looking for one more mother to fill in the show. I'd love to have someone in an unusual circumstance. I'd love to have the grandmother who's raising the grandkids. I'd love to have the mother who's fostering kids, something like that. AbstractMe@AOL.com. I'm also looking for a topic for Memorial Day weekend. I always love to get topics and guests from folks. And then once again, I will remind you, get your pet some tags on contact information for when your dog or cat wanders off. All right, Barbara Norden in the studio as we talk about Judy Jones wandering off in May of 1969. Barbara, so you mentioned finding the shovel and the bathrobe sleeve in the crawl space and determining or trying to determine whether or not the shovel is a work rag, a tool, and the sleeve is a sort of a cleanup rag for evil things that might have happened. How do you, you know, you're 30 years later, what do you do to determine whether that's the case or whether you just add that into part of a good, potentially fictional tale?
Well, I took the, Paul and I met with Richard, Hudson, yeah, at the city police, and he's the one who had worked with the FBI and the state medical examiner at the time they were digging, and he was not very helpful, frankly. He did send them off to the state serology lab, where I have no doubt those items were promptly, you know, promptly stored away. Now, I am going to actually try to see if we can locate them there. Probably hopeless. But anyway, I'd like to just get them back and get the, I think maybe the new police chief might be willing to be helpful. Get them back and just take them to a private lab and have them tested. Is that blood? There's plenty of evidence they could pick up for DNA, I would think. If so, they could compare it to Carol and see what they come up with. It makes sense that, you know, one of the boys remembers driving somewhere very early with someone who was not his mother. Well, Hazel had a paper route that she would do early in the morning, and it kind of makes sense to me that they would have just gotten the body out of sight, taken whatever they had on hand, maybe the bathrobe she was wearing, ripped off a big hunk, and, you know, kind of tried to mop up the blood. Hazel gets the kids out of the house, goes out, just drives around until it's time to do the paper route. Meanwhile, Tom's back at the homestead, you know, getting rid of the evidence. Now, it could have been in that barn area if this is what happened. Later, a friend who's an archaeologist, Paul and I took him back over there and kind of showed him the lay of the land. And if people are familiar at all with this area, you know, there's still a lot of real wild stuff in that neck of the woods. If you continue up Stribling Avenue, it starts meandering around. You go by a big power station. Eventually, you go through a railroad tunnel. And then you are really embarking on an old, twisty road that ends up on Fontaine Avenue by the Research Park. You know, drive this sometime if you're curious. And Bob, the archaeologist, felt that it was much more likely that Tom would have just loaded Judy's body in the car. And if it's wild now, imagine what it was like 40 years ago, taken it somewhere in the depths of that very wild, weird area that borders on the railroad tracks and buried her there, or even just dumped her, but more likely buried her there. So I don't think there's any hope that her body will ever be found. As I said, both Tom and Hazel are dead. Carol told me that when she was standing at her mother's bedside, when her mother was unconscious and dying, she said, "What happened with Judy?" And all the, you know, monitors on her body kind of jumped. I think that Hazel probably was an unwitting accessory to this, you know, didn't stop this violent argument when she should have stepped in. She was probably as angry at Judy as Tom was. And then, oops, you know, her daughter's dead. Well, what's she going to do in her mind? You know, get honest and call the police, or frantically try to cover up and say, look, we'll just say she ran away. I think that she covered up and said, we will just say she ran away. I don't think she did.
Now, you spent a fair amount of time, and suddenly I have this blank, like I've also read the story about the two young women at the Appalachian Trail. You're not mixing these
Julie
two up, are you?
Julie Williams,
but with the back to Judy Jones, you spent a lot of time with the family in Fredericksburg.
Yeah. Yeah,
and gathered a lot of information from them that helped if my memory serves me right from the article that I read, it filled some answers here for you, but gave you a another path entirely as a possibility, correct?
Are you referring to the fact that a then UVA student...
That's correct. She had a guy that she'd been with for like 3 weeks and who had taken her to Northern Virginia and then to Virginia Beach or something on his motorcycle somehow?
No, I don't think they were on a motorcycle. They were in a car. Now, and it's interesting, she hadn't been with him. I think he had been a regular, or he'd been a customer at Village Inn where she was a waitress. He said they'd only really gone out once that he could remember to Hamburger Joint somewhere on 6th.
But my memory 29. Of reading the article is that you weren't so sure that he was telling you the truth early on, and then he called you back to fill you in. And so then what I get out of the article is, well, if he doesn't have anything to hide, why in the world is he not just explaining what went on?
That was so. That whole part was very weird. The private detective had learned of him back in '69. I met the only one who's still alive of this group of detectives, and is still working as a PI. And he kind of just verbally went through the notes with me and kind of pieced together what they'd come up with. It hadn't been a very thorough investigation. But they did come across this guy, probably by talking at People Village Inn. He was a UVA student. He had an apartment on DeNova Court, which is right there by the stadium. And what the man remembered, he told me later this hadn't even been this way in the notes, he thought he remembered that they found out that Judy had gone to this guy's apartment. In fact, maybe the guy did have a motorcycle in that scenario. And he had left her there and, I don't know, gone to class or whatever, and she had told him she'd had an argument with her stepfather or mother or whatever and wanted to stay there, but when he went back, she was gone. He wrote a letter to her father. He didn't... I don't think he mentioned that. Maybe he did. He wrote a letter to Maynard, which you get the sense, knowing what I know from talking to him later, that he was really not being very forthcoming, kind of saying, geez, I don't have anything that would help. Okay, so I found him through, Alumni Association, called him up, big surprise to him, I'm sure, and... At first, I think he said he couldn't remember much, but then he called me back, and he had this wild story about how Judy had been talking about how she was going to go to Florida or California, and she wanted to go with him. He was going up to D.C. She wanted him to go with her, so he left her in a motel up there. And then he went back to get her, and she said, I really want to go to Virginia Beach. And he said, okay, I'm up for a trip to the beach. They went, and she checked into a motel, and he went somewhere, and he went back to the motel, and she was out in the parking lot with a couple of guys. And when he went back a second time, she had checked out and left. Weird, weird, weird. Did this guy have some role? Did she call him that night?
Do you think that he had any... Any part in this?
No, I doubt it. I doubt it very much. It would have meant that she was alive, that he simply, went over to Stribling Avenue from DeNova Court in the middle of the night to pick up this very attractive young woman that he probably had some interest in and brought her back to his apartment. Does he kill her? No, he does not. Murder her?
If she was seeing him at that time,
she
wouldn't have called him to say, by the way, I know that we only fooled around the one time, but I think I have gonorrhea.
Oh, she might have, but again, does a UVA student in 1969 murder a waitress at Village Inn that he might have had sex with and might have caught gonorrhea from? No, he goes to student health and gets a bunch of antibiotics and doesn't have anything more to do with her. He does not murder her.
Hello.
She never used her social security. She never used her credit card. She never once had any remorse and wanted to see her kids. Judy Jones dead.
11:53 on the wake up call with Barbara Norton. As we talk about Judy Jones, the unsolved mystery from May of 1969. Barbara, one of the unusual things about this, and again, we when we set up this show, it was, gosh, there are a handful of unsolved mysteries out there. And then, you know, as we realized this morning, this was not going to happen where at the 20-minute mark we could completely talk about one unsolved mystery in 20 minutes and then
sure.
move to another one for 20 minutes. And so we've been on and on about Judy Jones. But several here have all taken place in the spring. One of the ones that I'd like you to come back sometime this summer or fall and talk about are the two young women who were killed near the Appalachian Trail in May of 96. You mentioned early in the hour about your, I guess, I don't know that you called it your greatest fascination, but certainly the one.
Oh, my consuming passion.
But Patrick Collins, who disappeared in March of 1986. That's two right there in the same year within months of each other.
Wait, not.
No, 96 and 86. See my math coming out to
That's
play again.
Okay. That is okay.
But you've got this spring thing going. Is there, I'm not sure how many other incidents that you have paid attention to that have caught your attention. Why spring? I mean, does it have anything to do with that? Does it have something to do with you in terms of when you're looking
know.
For something to write about and these are the ones that catch your attention?
I do not know. Especially the milestones with Pat's disappearance. Was last seen on March 22nd. No one realized he was gone till I think April 4th. His parents gave up waiting for UVA to do anything and showed up in early May. They showed up around May 6th, 7th, 8th, somewhere in there. I'm keenly aware, particularly the dates of Pat's short time in Charlottesville. You know, they're all over the world. There are buried bodies that are just invisible. We've got Katie Worski, the little girl who was probably sexually assaulted by Glenn Barker and then murdered.
But again, no body.
No body.
I mean, he was found guilty, but
yeah.
with no
Would
body,
never
which is
say. Would
a,
never
which is
say.
A rarity in terms of
Very
percentages
rare.
For someone to be found guilty of a crime as severe as a murder. With
doesn't look good when the little girl's bloody underpants are in your dresser drawer. He finally stopped trying to pretend he didn't, but he never had the decency to tell her family what he did with her body.
There's the woman from Route 29 and the...
Well, now her body was found. I've been to that
The Route 29
spot.
Stalker?
Yes, I've been to the place where her body was
Alicia
found.
Alicia Showalter Reynolds.
Alicia Showalter Reynolds. Been to the campsite where Julie and Lolly were killed. I have seen the pictures of their murdered bodies.
See, now, to me, that's kind of freaky, Barbara.
Well, it is.
That's kind of, and you talked earlier about Tom being creepy, talking about, you know, talking with the people who are much younger than him about, you know, sex in
yep.
general.
And
but,
here you got a 56-year-old woman. You know, the horror of knowing what happened to Alicia, standing there and picturing them finding a man walking down a deserted road near Culpeper and seeing vultures and venturing into the woods, wondering what they were circling for, and imagining that wonderful, wonderful, beautiful human being lying there after being dead for a couple months, and seeing Julie and Lolly's beautiful, beautiful spirit-filled bodies butchered in a campsite. And the people who did these killings, okay, Glenn Barker did some time. No one else has suffered at all for what happened to these others. It's just the injustice of that. Those bodies and those pictures could have been one of my nieces. It could have been me. You know, I live on St. Clair Avenue. Jane, can't remember her last name, was just the wonderful young woman who was murdered across the street from me in November because a couple of creeps wanted to steal her laptop and the cash in her purse. They shot her in the head. So,
well, let me ask you this.
Life's intense.
Let me do this real quick. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. The last minute or so with Barbara Norden talking about mostly about the unsolved mystery of Judy Jones, who disappeared in May of 1969. Barbara is convinced that Judy is dead. No use of her Social Security card or any credit cards or money, never any effort made to see her four kids after disappearing on the early part of May. And we talked, we threw out here at the end these other cases. Having had you on the show before, I know that you feel that the University of Virginia police did a horrible job in the spring of 86 in working with Pat Collins. You made reference to someone in from the Charlottesville Police Department in the Judy Jones issue not doing such a great job there. The Julie Williams and Lolly Winans, you talked about, or I read in the article about how these gentlemen or the folks doing the research of this failed to do some things that might have helped solve this a little more directly. What's your general comment? And I've given you 30 seconds now on research and detection.
It's a lot of prejudice going on. I think that UVA police, apparently there's a reason to believe they'd found out that Pat was almost certainly gay, and they just wrote him off as he didn't want to come out to his family, and so he disappeared. That was the UVA police in the same era as when Liz Sikora, who had been raped in a fraternity house, urged her and her father not to file an actual report. 1985-86 era of UVA police. I think that they judged her as a rape victim who shouldn't have been in a frat house getting drunk, and though it was probably a date rape pill, and Pat is a gay man who they didn't even want to think about. So, yeah, I mean, in those two cases, I think we can look. And then 69, police say, gosh, she was blonde, she was working as a waitress, husband's off in the Navy, she just took off.
All right, so you're going to come back over the summer or in the fall to talk about some of these other cases?
I'd love to for you to hear from listeners as to what they'd like to hear about.
AbstractMe@AOL.com. If you want to get the article, we'll take care of getting that to you in paper form. Otherwise, next week is Mother's Day. Barbara, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick, and everybody here.
Next up, Les Temps Perdue.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Michael Strickland. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.